last time I took a road trip? How many national parks could I hit in 2 weeks? What about hotels? Wait, hey, Erica, how much am I spending on travel?
When your questions about life turn into questions about money, there's Erica, the virtual financial assistant to help you spend, save, and plan smarter. Only from Bank of America. What would you like the power to do? Erica is only available in the English language. You must download the latest version of the mobile banking app, only available on select mobile devices. Your chat may be recorded and monitored for quality assurance. Message and data rates and additional terms may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to The Rest Is Money with me, Steph McGovern.
And me, Robert Peston. How are you, Steph? What have you been up to?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. I've had a very child-heavy weekend, been doing lots of things like swimming lessons, but without the drama with the costume this time. And in fact, I didn't even get in the pool. I was so traumatised by the last time. But lots of fun family stuff, which has been great. What about you?
So obviously I've been boring you rigid with, you know, midlife crisis, centrist dad, my band.
You've just sent me the booking link. I was like, why has he sent me this?
Because we've got a gig coming up in a well-known venue and you're invited.
Very good. Where is the venue?
I don't think I'm going to say because it's not the biggest venue, and I suppose, truthfully, well, we want to keep the people there to friends just for obvious reasons.
Oh my God, you're going to get stormed, aren't you? You know, you're going to be sell faster than, what is it, Rory and Alistair sold the London Palladium faster than the Foo Fighters or something.
Did they do that?
Yeah. Is it going to be like that?
Yeah, we are North London's Foo Fighters, definitely.
Right. So we are going to answer questions in this episode today. Just a reminder, if you want to send them in, it's restismoney@gmail.com, or you can send them on our social media. So our first question actually comes from two of our mates who present The Rest Is Entertainment, Richard Osman and Marina Hyde. And so they were talking about Trump. Here's what they had to say.
And that's the sort of thing we need to ask The Rest Is Money about, right? Peston and McGovern would tell us how something which has never made any money at all, which shows no sign of making any money at all, which advertisers don't show any sign in having an interest in advertising on, how that can suddenly be worth $6 billion.
Yeah, because then we need to do it ourselves.
So that, of course, was our wonderful colleagues from The Rest Is Entertainment, Richard Osman and Marina Hyde. Thanks, Richard and Marina.
They've been talking about Trump and what's been going on with him and, you know, him set to become president again and basically where he's getting his money from. And they were talking about this whole merger between Trump Media and Technology Group, which is, of course, the business that owns his Truth Social's media site, which is basically the only place where you'll hear Trump in a social media sense, because that's the only place he posts to. So that company, Trump Media and Technology Groups, merged with Digital World Acquisition Corp. And when these rumours came out it was going to merge, the share price rocketed. Richard and Marina were talking about how they were worth something like $3 billion, his stake in the shares. But actually, it's now what, 4.6?
Yeah, so at the close of play on Tuesday, after this astonishing rise in the share price of this business, it's effectively the first day of trading in this business because of the merger, shares absolutely soar. Trump's shares, as you say, worth $4.6 billion. And quite strikingly, for the first time ever, I know he boasts about what a billionaire he is, but the first time ever, he has joined, as a result of this flotation, this IPO, he has joined the world's wealthiest 500 people, according to the Bloomberg Billionaires Index.
My God, his head is just going to be even bigger now. It's funny how he's labelled it on the stock market as well. He's used his initials, hasn't he, for the ticker of trading. So it's DJT, Trump's initials there.
It is. And actually, another thing that's interesting, it's also come out as part of this whole IPO of this business, is, do you remember how we were talking last week about TikTok? And about how Donald Trump has moved from being, when he was president, in the camp of people who were saying the Chinese had to pull out of the American version of TikTok, and now he's not so sure whether it's right to close TikTok down in America if, you know, the Chinese don't dispose of it. And we pointed to the fact that one of his mates, also one of his great supporters, is a billionaire called Jeff Yass, who is actually worth considerably more, we think, than Donald Trump. It turns out, and the reason why that mattered, we pointed this out, is that Yass is a big investor in the parent company of TikTok, ByteDance. Well, it turns out there's another connection, financial connection, between Yass and Trump. It looks like he owns a small shareholding in the shell company that Trump's business has merged with. So Yass himself is a few million dollars richer as a result of the Trump flotation.
Richard and Marina's question off the back of all this is, how can a company be worth that much money when basically, you know, it's never made a profit and it doesn't look like it's got any prospects to?
I mean, one answer is the greater fool theory, which we might come back to, but let's break it down and try to give us a slightly more rational explanation initially. Truth Social, it makes tiny amounts of money. I think its revenues for the first 9 months of last year were about $3 million. And so if you were using, obviously, conventional measures of value, you would say this company is massively overvalued. I mean, you know, multiple billion market cap, almost no revenues, a few million dollars at most. But it's all about a bet that he becomes president. And actually, the opinion polls seem to indicate that he may become president. You know, free world feeling slightly nervous about that, perhaps. And at that point, given that it's the only social media site that he uses, you would slightly assume that the numbers of people that use Truth Social,
860,000 users at the moment, which is nothing.
But you'd slightly assume if he decides, which is he's quite capable of doing as president, that this is the only channel of communication he's going to use at that point. Rather, more people decide they have to tune in. And
that's
at that point, it becomes a more valuable business.
Can you see a world then in which the president of the United States is only giving comms through a social media site he owns? That just seems wild.
But Steph, if you remember, we were all incredibly shocked, you know, after he won the presidency, or indeed even in the run-up to the presidency victory in 2016, we were all shocked that he used Twitter, now called X, but he used Twitter for pretty much every single bit of official and non-official communication. That in itself completely changed the model of presidential communication. He's quite capable of simply deciding that, you know, he wants to line his own pocket and, you know, even as president, that therefore this is the only social media platform that he, you know, in inverted commas, trusts.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, poor old Elon Musk will be weeping because Elon is desperate to get him back onto X, because he was a great driver. You know, wherever he goes, he is a driver of traffic. I mean, shouldn't, you know, the reason he's going to win the presidency, probably, I mean, actually, I don't know whether he's going to win. Actually, we can talk about this another time. I actually brought, when people ask me, I actually think Biden, for reasons I probably need to talk to you about on a different kind of podcast. But anyway, I actually think there's a pretty good chance Biden will win. But let's put that to one side. The opinion polls indicate that Trump may well win. And why is that? It's because, you know, the people who love him, love him. And if they love him as a politician, they're also going to love him as a businessman, even though... And we should be clear about this. His record as a businessman is really ropey. There was some analysis done a few years ago looking at what he inherited and, you know, what his net assets are now. And it didn't look, you know, this idea that he is this amazing entrepreneur doesn't really stack up if he'd simply put that fortune that he inherited into the stock market and bonds and been a passive investor. Certainly, according to this analysis, he would have been just as wealthy today, or even conceivably more wealthy. So, you know, the notion that he is this great wealth creator...
It's bollocks.
Well, all right, I was going to use the word moot, which is a but, and, you know, given that he also is facing... at this time, and you know, you might want to remind us how much trouble he's in there. But I mean, you know, he is facing this fraud case in New York, which is one of the reasons he needs all this money.
Yes, because this all comes back to money. This whole merger with this Digital World Acquisition Corp is so it could float on the stock exchange, and it's so he could basically create this money, because he's going to owe a lot in these court cases, isn't he? And what everyone is suggesting now, the element to this is that he's probably going to dump this stock, isn't he? He's probably going to sell off his stock in order to...
But he can't in the short term without the approval of his fellow directors.
Yeah, directors is literally Donald Trump Jr. Yeah. and his mates. So they're going to agree that he can sell it off, aren't they? Which means he's using this as a way to raise money. He's got, you know, the people who've pumped money into this to buy shares and pushed up the price... They're Trump fans, aren't they? Like you say, the people who are thinking this is a way of kind of supporting him, but it could all come crashing down if he dumps the stock.
I mean, I'm sure a lot of them are people who just want to, in a sense, help him stay afloat and regard all these court cases as some kind of Democrat conspiracy against him. And therefore, you know, they want to prop him up. We should actually, though, look at this phenomenon, the SPAC phenomenon. You know, these companies, special purpose acquisition companies, or SPACs,
shells,
and they're shell companies. And there was a bit of a mania for them from about 2020 onwards. And these are shell companies led by, you know, sometimes charismatic individuals who investors sort of bet on as an individual that they're going to make deals that turn an empty company into an incredibly valuable company. And there is something, you know, for those people who aren't, you know, sort of immersed in stock markets, there's something slightly weird about the ability of an individual to raise billions of dollars on the hope that they do some good deals, which is what the SPAC craze, the SPAC phenomenon was all about. But it's as old as history that people, sometimes they're conned, but sometimes people do make money by identifying somebody who looks like, you know, a business genius or just somebody who's very talented, throwing money at them. And as I say, it's a gamble, but sometimes it pays off massively.
Yeah.
But with any business, I mean, you'll know this, the quality of the leader in terms of whether you get money from investors is incredibly important. I mean, I remember when I was first looking at this stuff in the 80s and 90s, you know, the cult of the sort of, you know, the so-called business genius at the top of a company. And, you know, they were the companies that found it way easier to raise, you know, colossal sums of money.
But that brings us back to something we talked about in the past, which is someone like Adam Newman and WeWork. There was so much hype around him as the leader of WeWork. And, you know, he, you know, got incredible amounts of investment, but it was never worth it, was it? It turned into a massive flop. So that you kind of, it's always betting. That's what it feels like in business. You're always, if you're, you know, with stocks and shares, it feels like it's always a gamble.
So sometimes it's a story, and, you know, sometimes the story told by the leader is fiction, but sometimes the story is very persuasive. I had a cup of coffee yesterday with a really, actually, I have to say, I mean, I don't think I was conned, but, you know, a really impressive Italian.
Did you give them some money?
No, I was more talking to him because of the industry he's in, which I'm pretty interested in.
So,
he's a bloke called Stefan Buono, and he created a brand new business called New Clio. Right, it's a sort of you got the pun. Mm. It's New Clio. It's a developer of these new smaller modular nuclear reactors to generate electricity. Right, and it's an amazing story actually, because they've taken a technology that was used in Russian nuclear submarines decades ago, which are these lead-lined nuclear reactors, and they are now they own all the intellectual property for them, and they are now trying to build these reactors in Europe. Right, and it's for them it's a particularly green technology, because what they do is they take nuclear waste, plutonium, and then they repurpose it as fuel for these smaller modular reactors. Mm. And so it sounds like an amazing story. You're both dealing with the waste. It's in theory, because there's no carbon emissions, except I suppose in the sort of development, as it were, of the actual power plants, where there are always carbon emissions, but there are carbon emissions when you build a wind farm. Anyway, so it seems clean.
Yeah.
And this guy does have a track record, because he is a nuclear engineer, and he actually developed a nuclear medicine business that was sold to Novartis a few years ago for a few billion. And so he sets up this business.
So he's loaded.
And investors chuck money at him. I mean, he's raised hundreds of billions of dollars already, way more than he actually thought he needed. But, you know, this is now a very substantial operation. I mean, the reason I was talking to him, actually, if to be clear, is because the thing that I found quite sort of striking is, because in 2020, 2021, Boris Johnson said, we are going to be a world leader again in nuclear, the company set up here, and now they've got no approvals here. And while the bureaucracy here is not giving him permission to start at all, he meets President Macron four or five times, and he's now got licenses to start developing in France.
Oh, wow.
And so it looks like, I mean, who knows? Maybe it looks better than it really is, but, you know, Macron is no fool, right? I mean, I think he met Grant Shapps when he was business secretary once by Zoom, but he's not met any British ministers. But Macron has personally intervened and has now basically said, you can use our nuclear waste, you can do a big site here. And he's still waiting for any kind of permission in the UK.
Yeah,
right? which is why I talked to him. But anyway, the reason I was talking to him is he was also very charismatic, and I thought, okay, I sort of get why investors are giving you money. But he also has, you know,
unlike others
who raise money, a genuine track record.
That story feels like another example of why we are behind in this country on, you know, energy creation, on leadership and things. If we are not seeing, like Macron's done with this guy, has seen the potential, and we just don't do that.
I mean, Macron's sort of behaving like an entrepreneur. And you sort of, when you've got a crisis, particularly a growth crisis, you sort of want a bit more of that from your leaders. But it also takes us on, because we were talking about the difference between a charismatic individual who has a genuinely exciting business plan and another one who's a con artist, which, as I mentioned at the beginning, the so-called greater fool theory of investment, which you'll remember because it became incredibly sort of popular and talked about during the dot-com boom of the late 90s. You know, when everybody could see that there was this massive stock market bubble, with whether it was your Boohoo's or, you know, even your lastminute.coms, that the values that were being put on these companies were off the charts, right? But investors believed that they could always, that there was always a greater fool who'd buy them out if they needed to. So the greater fool theory is, you know, you can sort of see that something's overvalued, but you hang on because you think, well, you know, other idiots are going to be piling in, and then I will find an even greater idiot than myself who will buy me out at the right moment. It's a very dangerous way of investing, because it turns out, because the risk is that you might end up being the greater fool.
Yes, depending on. Well, that's interesting, because coming back to this whole merger between Trump's business and this digital world, this shell company, people have already started selling the shares as well. So there will be people who, you know, just jumped in on this and thought, well, I can make a bit of money here and then sell them off. Speaking of fools, can I, I don't think I've ever told this story about when I met Trump and had to interview him, because you know that whole point you were saying about charisma and things. Mm. I remember when I was interviewing Donald Trump when he was in the UK once, because he was wanting to moan about the wind farms near his golf club. Yeah. So he he'd agreed to do this interview with me on that basis, but obviously with a view of it being a much more wide-reaching interview. And this was before he was president. So, you know, he was doing The Apprentice and things like that. He was still a massive name at the time. But when he walked into the room, he did this. It was so surreal. So before he arrived, his team, you know, these people who think they're important always have a massive entourage, don't they? They have all their different advisors and various other people. And they will always say to you before the interview starts, you know, there's certain questions you're not allowed to ask. Or as soon as Mr. Trump walks in, you've got 10 minutes with him and it starts the minute he walks in, blah, blah, blah. Don't ask him about his hair. Don't ask him about his ex-wife, which instantly puts in my head, final question, what does your ex-wife think? Think about your hair. Anyway, so that all of that carry on goes on. It's something, you know, you and I have experienced for years. I remember when I was your producer that I would always have that argument with the SPAD of whoever, the special advisor to whichever politician we were interviewing. We'd have this cat and mouse game. But with Trump, so I got told all this and then he walked into the room and he just stopped dead in the room and just looked at me and just went, wow. You're so beautiful. I can't do his voice. I won't try. I used to be able to do his hair quite well, though. Anyway, he said...
So that, obviously, this is a man of judgment, is what you're about to tell
no,
me.
No, it isn't. That's the point. He goes, wow, you're so beautiful. If we do this interview now, everyone's just going to be staring at you and not listening to me. So I'm going to leave the room and make myself look better. He then genuinely went to walk out of the room, at which point I am just burst out laughing because this is the most weird compliment I've ever had. So I was, and I knew it wasn't a compliment. It was him trying to disarm me. He was thinking, female journalist, what will she care about? She'll care about how she looks. And I do care about how I look, but I'm more bothered about content. And anyway, I just replied back and it was a bit of a like, well, I don't really know what to say. I was like, oh, love, I've heard better lines than that damn Club Bongo. And that was my genuine response to Trump. And then I think he thought that I was then coming on to him because he then just was like, whoa. But what was interesting was he was like that with me. So he'd done this overkill of being, you know, telling me I'm beautiful, whatever. But with the male producer, he did the opposite. He did like this aggressive macho thing of after the interview, he went over and like slapped him on the back. A lovely guy called Sean Farrington, who now presents Wake Up to Money. But he went up to him, slapped him on the back and was like, hey, Sean, you know, you're basically saying you better make me look good in this edit. Otherwise, you'll have no career. It was just like the two extremes of his, you know, his way of dealing with people. But to be fair to him, when he did have charisma in the room, like lots of people, you know, I myself was like, yes, you have got charisma, whether you agree with him or not. But he was a bit of a twat. I don't know if you can use that word on the podcast, but there we are. I've just bombed it in. We're meant to be answering other questions, should we?
Well, we've answered Richard and Marina of Central London's question. So I think it's probably time to move on to some other questions. So we've got a question from Tom Bullock, and it's about the impact of leap years. It says this year is a leap year. He was wondering whether working an extra day affects the world of business and finance positively or negatively once every 4 years. So, yeah. Come on, Steph.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of adjusted away in the statistics, isn't it? But the Centre for Economic and Business Research did some analysis on it, which got quite a few headlines at the time. And they worked out that it boosts the economy by 8.6 billion pounds, plus it adds 0.3% to GDP. But that's a mathematical thing, it's not reality in the sense of these things all smooth themselves out in the end. But yeah, in short, that's what they reckon it adds. But the reality is you won't see that reflected in the statistics, will you?
I mean, the point is, which I know that Tom understands, is that, you know, it's the amount that any of us produces, you know, per hour, per day, that matters, not some sort of notional GDP figure for a leap year versus a non-leap year. And I'm afraid just the harsh reality is if the extra day happens to have fall on a working week, as an employee, you may go boo-hoo.
You don't earn any more money, do you? Because your salary doesn't change, but you are working an extra day. Because I was reading that this year as well, you've got the leap day, which is an extra working day. You've got there's one less bank holiday and there's one less weekend day. So actually, there's three more days of working this year than next year.
Which you're not being paid for, are you?
Yeah. Well, if you're on a salary, no. But if you're freelance, very different. But again, that comes back to only if you work weekdays and not weekends. But it is an interesting question, Tom. And in short, doesn't really make much difference.
Well, I think your point was you get better value for money from your employees if you're a business owner.
Yeah. Right, it's time for a break, after which we will be answering more of your questions. We've got all sorts of things. People asking about what it means to be economically inactive and why they use that term. Also, someone wondering how we can sort out their housing market problems by incentivising older people to sell their larger properties. And that's all coming up after this break.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
Welcome back to The Rest Is Money with me, Steph McGovern.
And with me, Robert Peston.
So we're answering your questions. We've got questions about the gig economy, about being economically inactive, and also about the housing market and how we can encourage the older folk in big houses to move to smaller ones and free things up in the housing market. But let's start with this question about economic inactivity. So Deborah asked this one. She says, why is my retired husband economically inactive? He still pays tax and buys stuff. Previously, he worked in a state school, which doesn't produce anything economically measurable. So I genuinely don't understand why he's considered economically inactive simply because he's now paid from a pension fund rather than from education funds. Come to that, I don't understand how I'm economically active working in public service. I don't do anything which generates wealth in my role. Please explain, because I understand your explanations.
So one of the things that I think we absolutely have to take head on as a society is this idea that if you work in the public sector, you are not, you know, in inverted commas, producing something valuable. Education, the education of our children, the giving them the ability to thrive in life, that is unbelievably valuable. And yes, Deborah is right that it's quite hard to put a monetary value on it. You know, in the days when you were making garden equipment, you could measure your output by the value of the garden equipment.
When I worked at Black & Decker, I should add.
You could obviously measure your output by, what were you making, blowers or something?
Leaf blowers,
there we are. So, I mean, you know.
It was called a leaf hog, yeah.
Yeah, so you know, that leaf hog has a retail value. We can work out, you know, the value of your output. Now, a class of 30 children, as a brilliant teacher, if you are, you know, giving them the resilience and the knowledge to thrive in this very challenging world, that's incredibly valuable. And I think, you know, so when he worked in a state school, your partner, Deborah, was incredibly, I think, productive. And, you know, you don't say what you do in public services, but you say you work in public service. But again, I'm absolutely certain that what you do is stuff that society needs. And in fact, you know, to be clear, when, you know, there are two separate questions here for me. One is when we do the calculations about productivity and GDP and all the rest of it, there is an issue around whether, you know, the Office for National Statistics, which makes these calculations, puts the right value on the output of the public sector. But separately from that, I actually have quite a sort of strong sort of ethical view on this, which is we have to value public servants, and in more than just monetary terms, we just have to recognise these people do, you know, absolutely vital work. And although, and I think the heart of your question is that your husband is obviously making a contribution to the economy because he's spending money. Yes, of course. In that sense, he's making a contribution to the economy. But it's spending is different from working.
Essentially this idea of being inactive or not in this economic sense. It's a definition which is used by statisticians to work out what type of people there are in the economy to allow them to analyse what's going on in the jobs market. So if you're in work or you're looking for work, you're economically active. If you're not in work and you're not looking because you're retired, which is in Deborah's husband's case, or you're too ill or you're studying full time, then you're economically inactive. So they use these terms in order to just work out what's happening in the jobs market. But I agree, I think they're really unhelpful in another sense. For example, I hate it when we label jobs as either skilled or unskilled, because I would argue every single job needs an element of skill to it. And I think it was shown during, and the kind of underlying thing to that is that skilled jobs are more important than unskilled jobs. And that again really annoys me. We all saw in the pandemic, the most important people, a lot of them would be deemed unskilled by these definitions, you know, that we have, when actually the society would have collapsed without a lot of them. You know, if we're talking about people collecting rubbish or people working frontline in the supermarkets or frontline in anything, that, you know, those types of people actually are the backbone to the economy. So it really drives me nuts when we do these definitions.
I mean, at the moment, the reason why this distinction between active and inactive, you know, is being talked about so much is because since the onset of COVID, the number of people classified as inactive has risen very sharply. And from memory, there are something like 500,000 people since the onset of COVID who have labelled themselves or been told by their doctors that they are either physically too unwell to work, mm-hmm. or have mental health issues, which makes it very difficult for them to work. And at the same time, we've got massive shortages in some industries of people. You know, there are many, many employers who are saying we just can't get the staff, the employees, the skilled and unskilled people we need. And so one of the biggest challenges for the government, and you hear, you know, for example, the Chancellor talking about this a lot, and it's featured in both the last budget and in the fiscal event that he did before that, is, you know, he is trying to create both carrots and sticks to get people who are classified as economically inactive back into the jobs market to make themselves available for work. And there's a fair amount of controversy, you know, around the way that they're reforming the benefits system. Because there is always a question when you reform the benefit system to try and encourage people back into work about whether you're penalising people who the state should be supporting and shouldn't be forced back into work. And so there's an interesting question, you know, around, let's go back to Deborah, and maybe she'll come back and tell us, you know, whether her husband would consider going back into the workforce, you know, in different sorts of conditions. If, you know, he may have just decided, I want to retire, I just want to, you know, do the other things that people do in retirement. But there is this really interesting debate going on about, you know, even people who are over 60, even over 70, a lot of them are capable of working in a physical sense. They've chosen not to. You know, what would it take to persuade those people to go back into the workforce? And because this feeds into not only the, you know, the terrible problems that some industries have recruiting the right people, it also feeds into the whole debate over immigration. One of the reasons, you know, we've got, you know, hundreds of thousands of people coming to this country from abroad is because quite a lot of people who live here don't want to work. Mm. And so if you think immigration is a problem, then you've got to somehow find a system, or you've got to change the incentives so that people who choose not to work, you know, change their minds and decide working is worth it.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually got quite a few messages on my social media pages as well this week. So thank you to everyone who sent in those as well. And one of them, which is a really good question, how can the government incentivize older couples to downsize to free up larger family homes? That's a question that's come from Deborah. And Robert, we talked about this, didn't we? We were talking about the housing market. We did a whole special on this, which you can listen back to. But you had some quite kind of novel ideas you've talked about in terms of how we incentivize the older generation.
I mean, I think this is such an important question, because the thing that we pointed out in our housing special is that an astonishing number of people live in homes that are way too big for them. And I haven't got the statistics in front of me. And as I said, we did give those statistics in that housing special. But the summary of this is, if you could persuade people, particularly older people, to downsize, move into smaller properties, you could solve perhaps not the entire housing shortage crisis in this country, but my goodness, you'd make an enormous dent in the problem. And so my suggestion, you know, I haven't mentioned my book Bust for some time.
I know you haven't actually.
I'm feeling nostalgic for it, so I'm going to bring it back. Anyway, in that book, my suggestion is that you reform the stamp duty system. Stamp duty is a big whack of money that people pay when they're buying a house. And my suggestion was that if you are selling to downsize, you know, you should basically be exempt the stamp duty on the purchase of the smaller property, because I think that would be a massive tax incentive for individuals.
Yeah, good idea. And as we said, we have done a whole special on that. If you want to listen back to that housing special, then we will put the link to it in the description for this episode. Right, we better wrap things up then. Thank you for all the questions. Just a reminder, you can send them to us on email, restismoney@gmail.com, or you can send them via our social medias. Just search The Rest Is Money, or you can send them to Robert and I's personal account. But anyway, that's it from us. We will be back with another episode soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.